The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. I think you'll find today's subject especially fascinating. It's a subject that we haven't really delved into during our podcast series. Often we talk about various types of therapies. We talk about vitamin supplements. We talk about different types of medical maladies. But today we're going to talk about something called the radical remission. And that is the title of a book by today's guest. She is Dr. Kelly Turner, and she is the founder of the Radical Remission Project. That sounds intriguing. What's that all about? She specializes in the study of remission of cancer. And the definition of that is a remission that occurs either in the absence of Western medicine or after Western medicine is proven ineffective. So this is a phenomenon that has fascinated her because she received her bachelor's degree from Harvard University and later went on to obtain a PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, and her dissertation focused on the concept of radical remission. And we're going to talk about that momentarily. Her new book, just out, The Radical Remission, or actually just Radical Remission. Welcome to the program, Dr. Turner. It's nice having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thank you very much for having me, Dr. Hoffman. Happy to be here.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about how you got involved in this unique project.
Well, like you said, I study radical remission, which some of your listeners might know as spontaneous remission. That's what it's called in the medical field, and we can talk perhaps a bit later about why I do not like that term, spontaneous, and I don't use it. But that's what I've been studying for the past 10 years. And what got me into it is that I was actually just counseling cancer patients. I was doing psychotherapy with them, and I was very happy to be doing just that. I got my master's in that. I started studying psychology and the mind-body connection while at Harvard, and then I ended up going for my master's at UC Berkeley, specifically in order to counsel cancer patients. And that was going to be my plan. That was supposed to be my life. But
you were just going to help when they were getting conventional therapy. You were going to help talk them through that and help them cope with the challenge and mental issues that are associated with having cancer. So your goal wasn't to transform the way that people were going to treat their cancer.
No, not at all. Not at all. Exactly. I was just helping people with the emotional roller coaster that is a cancer journey. And I was doing that out in San Francisco, out at UCSF, and also with a private oncologist. I was working with his patients. And I was really enjoying it. But I came across something during my lunch break. I was reading a book that I'm sure you've read, Dr. Hoffman, called Spontaneous Healing by Andrew Weil.
Indeed,
and
yeah.
It's a classic. And it had been on my, must-read list for a long time. So I finally got around to it, and in there is a case of spontaneous or radical remission. And it just made me freeze. And I said, how come I haven't heard of this before? And if this is in Dr. Weil's book, why wasn't it on the front page of the newspaper 10 years ago when this book came out? This is a big deal for someone with stage 4 cancer to be sent home on hospice and then turn it around themselves and be here 25 years later. That is noteworthy.
Yeah.
And it stuck with me enough that when I went home that night, of course, I'd been trained in research, so I did a little of my own research looking in the medical journals for these cases, and I quickly found that there were over 1,000 of these cases published in medical journals. So they've been verified, they've been peer-reviewed, they've been published. But no one was looking at them all together, right? No one was taking all these cases in a group and trying to look for common threads. And I just decided that, because we don't have a cure for cancer yet, there's really no excuse for ignoring these cases.
Indeed.
Just moving on. Right?
In the past, however, this is a known phenomenon in medicine, so-called spontaneous remissions. Mm-hmm. And the way that, as you know, conventional medicine looks at this is that, you know, a certain number of people by sheer coincidence, by luck of the draw, by some biological phenomenon that is quirky or unknown, they just seem to get better. And there's no rhyme nor reason to it. But you undertook a project to see if there were common factors that might sort of underlie the science of remission, that remission wasn't just a fluke, that there may be some underlying guiding principles that may, you know, they certainly can't guarantee that people are going to go that route, but might Right. Increase the probability that someone is a candidate for remission.
Exactly. Because in these 1,000 cases that were in medical journals, they were just basic biomedical reports. And I kept having, you know, writing the same thing in the margin, which is, well, what does the patient think? And did the patient do anything to get well? And that question never asked in these published cases. You know, the doctors were looking for something that they had, you know, some medicine they had taken, or some change in their blood type or some genetic marker. But most of the people that I've interviewed tell me that I'm the first researcher or doctor to ask them what they did to get well. So that's really all it took. It took me sitting down with someone for 1, 2, up to 3 hours and saying, tell me everything that you think helped you to heal. And I did that. I've done that now over 200 times. I've done over 200 in-depth interviews, and I've analyzed over 1,000 cases. And I have
some of the cases are illustrated in the book. You know, we actually go into detail with case studies of people who illustrate one principle or another of remission.
Yeah, absolutely. There's 36 case studies that I list in the book. But like I said, there's 1,000 published cases, and there's an estimated 100,000 cases out there that just they're not reported because they're not tracked in the National Cancer Registry, which is another real hindrance to studying this phenomenon.
Well, another way to look at it is that sometimes people undertake therapy with something that is, you know, just designed to be palliative. You know, maybe they're going to give it a shot, they'll knock the cancer back, and then lo and behold, they're cured. So people go, hooray, that chemotherapy really was extraordinarily effective. But maybe it wasn't the immunotherapy, chemotherapy, radiation therapy that turned the corner for that patient. Maybe it was a contributing factor, but predictably, most patients with that particular cancer had a poor prognosis.
Exactly. And like I said, most of the people that I've studied, I'm just now starting to study people who are using complementary methods at the same time as Western methods, so at the very same time, in order to overcome a very serious prognosis. But for the most part, my research has just been people who've tried Western medicine, but it wasn't working, so then they had to switch to other methods, or people who, of their own personal choice, chose never to use Western medicine from the get-go. You know, sometimes they said, oh, well, can I try these other things first, and then if I need surgery or if I need chemo later, can I do it then? And they just ended up never needing it.
And that's a cleaner case, because you could always say, oh, well, you know, these people are deluded. They think that they're better because of their whatever, their belief system or vitamin that they took, or because of yoga, exercise, meditation. But actually, it was actually the chemo that did it. But you're looking at some people who said, look, I've got a stark prognosis. I don't even want to go down the route of conventional medicine. And they healed purely on the basis of some natural process.
Exactly. Yep. It's about half and half, the people that I've studied. Half. Everyone was officially diagnosed, and half of them decided not to pursue Western medicine, and the other half pursued Western medicine to its fullest. It didn't work, and at that point, they tried other things. And you're right. Some people might say, oh, well, the chemotherapy must have had a delayed reaction. But really, most doctors who look at these cases know that something, you know, really different is happening here, because these people were sent home on hospice with tumors that were growing. Mm-hmm. So it was clear that the chemotherapy wasn't working.
Wow. So very exciting. But I think, you know, from looking at the book, you drew the conclusion that there wasn't one, you know, it's not a book about, okay, low-carb diet. That's the salient feature of, you know, what gets everyone better. You know, put people on, you know, paleo diet, and that's the cure.
Right.
Clearly, different strokes for different folks, right?
Sort of, yeah.
With some common features.
So the people that I've studied, the radical remission survivors, did over 75 different things to try to get well. So in my research, you know, every time somebody said that they did something or made some change that they thought helped them heal, I wrote that down as a healing factor.
Mm-hmm.
And across all the hundreds of interviews that I did, there were over 75 different things that came up. Now, these are physical, emotional, and spiritual. The thing is that not everybody does all 75. I mean, mm-hmm. not even by a long shot.
Right.
But what I found after, you know, tabulating the frequency of these factors is that almost everyone I've studied did 9 of the 75.
Okay.
And so these are the top 9. Some people just did 8, and some people did, like, 1 a lot more than the other 8. So certainly there was room for variation there, but these were the 9 most common factors that came up.
And that's the basis of the book, is that 9 factors that are have commonality in terms of utility for achieving radical remission, correct?
Right. And I'm very cautious to say that, you know, that these will help you achieve radical remission. All we can say is that these are the 9 most common factors among the group of radical remission survivors. So, you know, we still don't know scientifically if there's something else that's special about this group. You know, they might have some genetic predisposition. There might be something that I missed in my research. So it's, you know, this is exploratory research. We can't say that it's, you know, causative, but we can say that it's descriptive. So that what we can say is that radical remission survivors have these 9 things in common. Whether or not they apply to a different population or a more general population, we don't know that yet. We're going to need, you know, a lot more research before we can make that conclusion.
Indeed. And so that's a lot easier than 75 different things if you can boil it down to 9. So
right.
Spoiler alert here, you know, clearly you're going to need the book to give you greater detail on this, but, you know, can you enumerate the 9?
Absolutely. The first 2 that I'll mention are physical. I'll wait for this siren to go past. Welcome to New York.
Well, that's okay, because are we both in New York?
Yes, I'm
because that happens
well.
Very often during my podcast. So when that happens, I tell patients that this just adds a note of realism
yes.
to the podcast, because we're broadcasting from Midtown Manhattan,
right.
You know, not in a hermetically sealed studio. So yeah, that's what happens.
Yeah, it's always a good reminder of health and life and to be grateful, right? Every time I hear a siren,
there was some poor unfortunate person yeah. going off to Weill Cornell Hospital or Langone Medical Center.
Right. So back to the 9, yeah, because I want to make sure that people know about these. The first 2 are physical, and again, these aren't in any ranking order. Some people were convinced that, you know, factor 7 was the most important, other people factor 1, and all we know is that, you know, everybody that I studied did these 9. So the first 2 are physical. First one is radically changing your diet, and we can talk more about how they did that. And the second one is taking herbs and supplements, of course, always under the guidance of a health professional. And the rest, the other 7, were mental, emotional, or spiritual.
Hmm.
And I think that that's because these people were very, very sick, and they had tried everything physical that their doctors had told them to do, for the most part. You know, half of them always did these things from the get-go, but the other half had tried lots and lots of physical interventions recommended by their doctor. So at the point when they were on hospice, you know, the one piece of their health that they hadn't tried to alter was sort of the mental emotional realm. And so I'll list them off briefly, and we can go into whichever ones you'd like to, Dr. Hoffman. But
sure.
Taking control of your health, using your intuition to help make health-related decisions, releasing suppressed emotions, so things like fear or stress or worry, increasing positive emotions, which is different than having a positive attitude all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about that.
Yeah.
Embracing social support, so allowing yourself to, you know, receive love and look for support from others. Deepening your spiritual connection, and this is related to more of a spiritual practice as opposed to any one belief.
Mm-hmm.
And last but not least is having strong reasons for living, which is different than having a fear of death. So,
wow.
Yeah, but a lot of subtleties in there, and what I found most interesting, and I'm sure we'll dive into these, and I'd be happy to tell you some stories,
sure,
some true stories, But, you know, the commonality when I sit back and look at these nine things is that directly or indirectly, they all boost the immune system. And when you've done everything that your doctors have told you to do for cancer and you've got, you know, there's nothing left to do, you're on hospice, the one, you know, thing that you do have is your immune system. And what we're finding scientifically is that mental emotional shifts really can have a very powerful impact on the immune system. And I think that's an important message to take away.
Well, that's a wonderful message, and I sure wish that every oncologist in America was equipped with your book, because this would be a wonderful adjunct to the conventional treatment. It's not either or. I'm sure you're the first one who would say this does not preclude conventional treatment. My book does not say eschew conventional treatment, because conventional treatment is, as the slogans sometimes go, burn, poison, cut, you know, which is sometimes the pejorative way that conventional cancer therapy is portrayed by some people who are into radical alternatives. They just say, you know, don't go conventional, just do alternative. Well, for some cancers, that may make sense. For other cancers, you need integrative therapy using both conventional therapy and alternative therapies. But it'd be great to combine some of these therapies with, or perhaps all nine, for every single cancer patient undergoing treatment in the United States.
Absolutely. That is my hope. That is my dream. I'm very quick to say, you know, on page 2 of my book that I'm in no way against Western medicine whatsoever. I'm not against chemosurgery or radiation. I'm just simply interested in healing. We as a group of researchers have been ignoring these people who've healed for 100 years now, and I think we have something to learn from them. And certainly, these nine things can all be done right alongside chemosurgery and radiation, with the perhaps the exception of taking herbs and supplements. And the caveat there is that you just need to be taking those under the guidance of a health professional, because you want to make sure you don't overburden your liver. You know, chemotherapy is processed through the liver, and so are many herbs. And so there's just, you know, that's the one thing that you want to be careful of. But for the rest of them, you could absolutely do them right alongside, and you'll help your immune system.
Well, we'll drill down on that in just a moment, but I just want to get something out of the way, which is, I'm sure you're familiar with the essay, the essay on illness as a metaphor, by Suzanne Sontag, who levels criticism at people who promote the idea that attitude is very important in cancer, that hope and positive mental outlook are very important, because what she says is this sometimes just makes cancer patients feel worse. They feel stigmatized because, well, not only did they get cancer, but perhaps in some way they brought it on themselves because of a bad attitude, or perhaps the reason for them going downhill is they don't have the mental fortitude or positive outlook that they should have. Isn't it tough enough being a cancer patient and suffering from a potentially fatal disease?
Yeah. This is a topic I take to heart, because as a counselor, you know, before I was a researcher, I was a, you know, psychotherapeutic counselor for cancer patients. So I was seeing this all the time. And so I tread this topic very carefully in my book, because I don't want to add to that idea of guilt. And the way that I usually talk about it is this way. First of all, nothing in my book is meant to say that even though these nine factors help people, you know, it apparently, right, that's all we can say is apparently these things that they have in common help them heal, doesn't mean that the lack of these things is what caused their cancer. So there's two issues. There's first the idea of guilt of, I must have caused my cancer by not feeling positive enough. Well, that's like saying, you know, I dropped my teapot and it smashed into 1,000 pieces and it broke because I didn't have glue, right? You can use glue to put a broken teapot back together. It doesn't mean that it broke because of a lack of glue.
Right.
And so if using these mind-body techniques, these mental and emotional techniques to boost your immune system, if they do end up boosting your immune system and helping your body fight cancer, it doesn't mean necessarily that the lack of these mind-body techniques is what caused your cancer in the first place. It's just simply a tool in your healing toolbox that a lot of people don't even know about, or even if they do, they don't think it's that powerful. And certainly the people that I study seem to think that the mental emotional processes are very powerful when it comes to healing. So the first issue of guilt is this idea of, did it cause my cancer? And I'm very clear in my book to say, you know, there's no research at all that shows that. The second issue of guilt is the idea that you have to stay positive all the time in order to heal, and if your cancer is getting worse, it's because you're not being positive enough. Now, this is a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Terrible. And I was so relieved, and I felt this way before I began my research, but as a researcher, my job is to be, you know, a blank slate, you know, just press record and not question. And I honestly did wonder what would come up along these lines, and I was a little nervous because I didn't want to hear somebody say, you got to be positive all the time. And thankfully, I was quite relieved that I did not hear that. I did not hear any of my radical remission survivors say, you've got to stay positive all the time, all the time. What I heard them say is, it's an emotional roller coaster, and fear will come at you sometimes as if you've been hit by a fire truck or by a fire hose, and it will just knock you down. But even on my darkest days, they would say, I found at least 5 minutes to feel peaceful or feel grateful or try to make myself laugh. And so there's a difference there, because, and it goes hand in hand, and we're sort of jumping into these two factors. The first one is increasing positive emotions. I purposely didn't call it, you know, have a positive attitude, because that
it's
implies...
It's like put on a smiley face, kind of, you know, have a nice day.
Yeah, all, right. And all the time.
Right.
And the people that I was studying were not, that's not what they were describing. They were saying that moments of joy seem to take their pain away, seem to help their physical symptoms get better, and so they started practicing joy just like you floss your teeth. So, you know, just like they tried to remember to floss every day or you know, eat their greens, they tried to laugh every day or feel joy or feel happiness.
It's almost like exercising a vestigial muscle, you know, a weak muscle that, you know, hasn't really been developed or utilized. It's something that needs to be cultivated because it doesn't come naturally.
Exactly. And especially when you've been thrown into cancer diagnosis, you know, it may be months since you've remembered feeling happy, but it is like, it's like a weak muscle. You need to use it every day, and then the more frequently you use it, the quicker it will come. And so that was the message from them, not to stay happy all the time. But it goes hand in hand with this idea of this other factor of releasing suppressed emotions. So this idea of putting on a happy face where underneath you have, you know, mounds of worry and stress and fear of death. The healers that I talked to, because I also interviewed alternative cancer healers from around the world, I spent a year traveling and went to 10 different countries. They think this is a ridiculous thing that has happened in the United States, this idea of put on a happy face. Because when people come to them, you know, they're sensing the energy, you know, the depths of these people, and they're saying above that veneer that you're of happiness is, you know, miles of fear and sorrow and regret from the past, and that's what we need to work on. You know, we don't need you to put on a happy face. We need to move this stuck energy that's in you, whether it was from a childhood trauma or from a more recent divorce or whatever it was. The radical remission survivors that I studied really worked on releasing any emotion they were holding on to in their body. So that, I think, is, you know, that combined with, you know, your 5 minutes of laughter a day, that seems to be most helpful for the immune system.
Wow. So we've laid out the 9 principles, and this is a good inflection point for us to pause in our podcast on the subject of radical remission. This is part one of our conversation with Dr. Kelly Turner, who has undertaken a study of what it takes to overcome cancer using unconventional means. And in part two, we're going to delve deeper into what is meant by radical diet change, utilization of supplements, herbs, and some of the attitudinal shifts that are requisites for a radical remission. We'll actually take a look at some of the cases. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.